This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 4th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 293. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the Big Deal feature, my guest is Benedict Rogers, journalist, co-founder of Hong Kong Watch, and the author of The China Nexus, 30 Years in and Around the Chinese Communist Party's Tyranny. Rogers visited Ottawa last week to launch Hong Kong Watch Canada. He is in Washington, D.C. this week. I'll get his thoughts on Justin Trudeau's ongoing China crisis, the 34th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, and more. But first, is it just me?
He will continue his work in sharing with Canadians the concerns and the solutions around foreign interference. And I look forward to him holding public hearings across the country over the coming months to include Canadians in this important conversation in a way that is grounded in facts. This is a serious issue. Unfortunately, the leader of the opposition is not choosing to take it seriously. He's choosing instead to fling mud and make personal attacks. That's not responsible leadership.
Is it just me, or is Prime Minister Justin Trudeau digging a deeper hole for himself and doing more damage to Canadian democracy by keeping his family friend David Johnston as the special rapporteur and by stubbornly refusing to call a public inquiry into China's interference in Canada? Last week, we heard from the Conservative leader from the 2021 election, Erin O'Toole, and longtime Vancouver NDP MP Jenny Kwan. After Johnston's report, Canada's spy agency met them both and told them that they were targets of the communist Chinese regime. Here is Jenny Kwan on May 29th outside the House of Commons.
I've had an opportunity to actually meet in a classified briefing with CSIS last Friday. While I'm not able to disclose the details of how that foreign interference applied to me specifically for national security reasons, CSIS has confirmed with me that I am being targeted for foreign interference and will continue to be a target. Okay. To that end, let me also offer these comments. The reason why I'm being targeted is because of my activism in support and to fight for basic human rights for not just Canadians, but for those who are abroad as well. It is my strong belief that those rights apply to the basic human being of who we are and our basic humanity. In the situation with Hong Kong, as you know, I was born in Hong Kong. And to see the situation unravel as it has and continues to breaks my heart. And I am outspoken about it to fight for the people of Hong Kong and to stand with the people of Hong Kong.
Here is Erin O'Toole on May 30th inside the House of Commons explaining the four ways that China targeted him.
That there was an orchestrated campaign of foreign interference in the 43rd Parliament and into the 2021 general election. The first category of threat is related to foreign funding, specifically the payment of funds by the Chinese Communist Party through the United Front Work Department to create specific products of misinformation on me as a member of Parliament and as leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. The second category of threat is related to human resources, specifically the use of groups of people working for or aligned with the United Front Work Department in Canada. They were organized and directed by a foreign state to amplify misinformation efforts and undermine my work as a member of this chamber and as leader of a parliamentary caucus. The third category of threat is related to foreign-controlled social media platforms. This category related specifically to the WeChat communications platform and its use to further the aims of the Chinese Communist Party and the United Front Work Department, and their campaign to spread misinformation to undermine and discredit my work in this chamber as the Member of Parliament for Durham and as leader of the official opposition. The final category of threat outlined to me, Madam Speaker, is related to voter suppression. Specifically, intelligence indicated an active campaign of voter suppression against me, the Conservative Party of Canada, and a candidate in one electoral district during the 2021 general election. I must acknowledge at this point, Madam Speaker, that I also believe my privileges as a member and officer of Parliament were infringed by the government's unwillingness or inability to act on intelligence related to foreign interference. The briefing from CSIS confirmed to me what I had suspected for quite some time, that my parliamentary caucus and myself were the target of a sophisticated misinformation and voter suppression campaign orchestrated by the People's Republic of China before and during the 2021 general election.
The Trudeau Liberals benefited from China's help to be in power and to stay in power. Are they hiding the smoking gun proof? What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast. Benedict Rogers is a journalist and co-founder of Hong Kong Watch. He is also the author of The China Nexus, 30 Years in and Around the Chinese Communist Party's Tyranny. He launched Hong Kong Watch Canada on May 31st in Ottawa. Hong Kong is home to 300,000 Canadians. It's the biggest concentration of Canadians outside of Canada. It is also a place where Beijing has taken away freedom of the press and freedom to gather for peaceful protest. Benedict Rogers is in Washington, D.C. this week to talk to lawmakers. Last week, he joined me from Ottawa on June 2nd, 2 days before the 34th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre of June 4th, 1989. Now, Benedict Rogers, before we look at how Hong Kong's government is preventing Hong Kongers from gathering this year to remember the victims of Tiananmen Square, I wonder if you can talk about expanding Hong Kong Watch, starting Hong Kong Watch Canada, and what your goals are.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you. We're very excited to have launched Hong Kong Watch Canada because Canada is a really important player in this question for the reasons you've just outlined, and because essentially now, along with the UK, it has the largest Hong Kong diaspora population. Thousands of Hong Kongers have left Hong Kong in the last couple of years because of the situation there. And both the UK government and the Canadian government have offered lifeboat schemes to help Hong Kongers to get out. So I think Canada is really important. We've been working in Canada for the last several years, and one of our co-founders, Aileen Calverley, is originally a Hong Konger, but a Canadian citizen. So she's been based here for some time, and we've had a team of people over the last couple of years working within the Hong Kong community and doing advocacy in Ottawa. But now we've officially launched it. And we have a number of patrons in the Canadian Parliament, and we will be continuing to advocate for Hong Kongers, for Canada to do more on the human rights situation, but also, for example, the very topical issue of foreign infiltration and intimidation by the Chinese Communist Party on Canadian soil, and the issue of Canadian pension fund providers. There are three in particular, Manulife, Sun Life, and Royal Bank of Canada, who are part of the Hong Kong pension scheme that the Hong Kong government is now preventing those Hong Kongers who take up the British pathway, the British National Overseas scheme, preventing them from withdrawing their pension savings. And so we're trying to shed light on that and put pressure on those Canadian pension fund providers to stop being complicit with the Hong Kong government's repression in that sense. So there's a range of issues we'll be working on, and we're delighted to have this presence in Canada.
You're in Ottawa the week after the release of the report by David Johnston, which has not done anything to really calm down Canadians' fears about the foreign interference by the CCP. And after that report, two of the three MPs who we know were targeted by the CCP went public and had after having meetings with Canada's spy agency, Aaron O'Toole, the leader of the Conservative Party during the 2021 election, and longtime NDP MP Jenny Kwan. You met with both of them as well as Michael Chong. You met with those three MPs separately. What did you learn from those meetings?
Well, I learned, I've known all three for some time. It wasn't the first time meeting them, and they've all been obviously very strong supporters of Hong Kong and of the work of Hong Kong Watch. But I learned that clearly they have been targeted, as they've said publicly. I think what the government has done and what the special rapporteur David Johnston has done is really woefully inadequate. I think that there is a need for, and of course I'm not a Canadian citizen, but I speak as a friend of Canada and someone concerned about these issues. There is a need for a public inquiry. And it's quite surprising to me that I think it was the day after I met with Jenny Kwan and she was at our launch. Her party, the NDP, had tabled a motion calling for David Johnston to step down and for a public inquiry to be held. And that motion was passed by the House of Commons. And yet within minutes of that happening, David Johnston issued a statement saying he reports to the Prime Minister, not to Parliament, and he would not resign, which seems to me a quite surprising decision to ignore the will of both Parliament and from the opinion polls I've seen, the concerns of the Canadian public. So I hope that the pressure will be maintained on the government to address this issue very seriously, because I'm quite sure that the three MPs that we are talking about are not alone. I would imagine this is a much wider problem and really needs robust action swiftly.
And David Johnston's report, he basically said there would be no public inquiry because he said there couldn't be a public inquiry because of too much top secret material that Canada could not allow or take a chance on getting into the wrong hands. Yet in Canadian history, going back to more recent times, back in 1985, the terrorist attack on the Air India flight that was blown up near Ireland, there was an inquiry after that. And they were able to hold the public inquiry at the same time as the inquiry commissioner was able to see the top secret material. Is this really just a case that the Prime Minister in many ways and the people around him are trying to manage an issue rather than get to the truth and find a way to solve this problem?
Well, it certainly appears to me that way. As you've described, Canada has a long tradition of public inquiries. We're familiar, I'm based in the UK, and we're familiar with public inquiries as well. And there's always an ability to conduct a transparent public inquiry whilst protecting both sensitive top secret information and the details of that information. And of course, there are legitimate concerns about protecting sources and witnesses and people who may be vulnerable to retaliation or repercussions. And those are legitimate concerns to protect such things. But you can have an inquiry where not everything that is presented to the inquiry body is made public. And I can't see a reason why that principle couldn't be applied here. So it does seem like the government and the Prime Minister have something to hide, or at least want to control and manage the process for political reasons.
What are your people on the ground telling you about how they're going to try to do that this year without getting arrested, or if they're going to get arrested to find defense with less media and less defense lawyers there? It seems like every week there's less of what there used to be in Hong Kong, which puts the people but further behind the eight ball.
Well, that's right. I mean, actually, one of the big challenges for us now is that because of the very draconian national security law that was imposed on Hong Kong 3 years ago, It's actually made it much, much more difficult for us to communicate directly with people on the ground. Before the National Security Law was introduced, we were in daily contact with dozens of people. But now most of our sources are either in prison or they've gone into exile, in which case we are in contact with them. And those who aren't in prison or exile, we're very cautious about having contact with them because one of the clauses of the National Security Law is what they call collusion with foreign political entities. And that can lead to criminal charges and prosecution. So just the act of communicating with us puts someone in real danger. So I'm not able to say much about what sources on the ground are actually saying. But I, knowing the Hong Kong people, I think that it's very likely that there will be some creative way to mark the anniversary. I don't know exactly the details of what may be being planned. Certainly, the big Victoria Park vigil can't happen. The Catholic Church and indeed other churches, but particularly the Catholic Church, always used to hold prayer vigils on either the eve of or the day of the Tiananmen Square massacre anniversary, and the Catholic Diocese in Hong Kong has announced they're not going to do that. But I think there will be people who will, you know, it may be something as simple as lighting a candle and having that candle visible in their window, which I know happened quite a bit last year. There may be people who will use the lights on their on their cell phones to send a symbolic signal. It'll be those sort of things. But I'm sure that people will find creative ways to continue to remember this, but it'll be much more difficult, more subtle, and at great risk.
By being the author of the book, The China Nexus, 30 Years in and Around the Chinese Communist Party's Tyranny, you have watched this evolve over the years. What do you think of the last 3 years, especially since 2020, the pandemic started, the imposition of the national security law in Hong Kong? Where are we now and what next?
Well, without doubt, I think China has changed very dramatically, particularly over the last decade of Xi Jinping's rule, and especially in the last 3 years. There was a period when I was traveling regularly in China in the 90s and the first decade of the 2000s, where there was, I think, a genuine reason to feel that China was perhaps relaxing. Maybe not reforming, but relaxing and opening up a bit. And you could see at that time, you know, some space, limited space, but some space for Chinese lawyers to defend human rights cases, some limited form of civil society, some degree of space for religious practitioners. And all of that has really almost completely disappeared in the last few years, so that anyone who raises their head against above the parapet faces the very real likelihood of disappearing and being jailed. And in terms of where we are now, I think the events of the last few years have started to wake up much of the free world to the challenges that the Chinese regime poses. I mean, it's rather too little too late and to varying degrees. I think the United States is perhaps quite a bit ahead of other countries. Countries like Canada and the UK are still trying to, on the one hand, recognize the challenge, but the large parts of our governments and elites that still want to do business as usual. Where we're going from here, I think under Xi Jinping, it's going to be more of the same. I think we'll see further repression at home, but also a much more belligerent, aggressive regime abroad, which we've already started to see and we'll see more of. So I think, and of course, the biggest challenge coming in the next few years is what's going to happen with Taiwan. I don't think we're in any doubt about Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party regime's intentions. They desire to take Taiwan. And the only thing that's in doubt is precisely when and how they may try to do it. But the likelihood of a military takeover or attempted takeover of Taiwan has certainly increased very significantly from where it was a few years ago. And I think we in the West need to really take that seriously and be prepared. And ideally, we need to be acting preemptively to send Beijing a clear warning of what the consequences would be, in the hope that that would prevent them from taking such what would be catastrophic action. But we're moving into a period of heightened tension, and a time where, whereas 10 years ago I would have been quite skeptical about people who warned of a conflict with China, I now think that has at least to be a possibility that we should take seriously.
I referenced the ascendancy to the World Trade Organization and opening up of trade. I guess the ultimate symbol of that eventually came 2008 with the Beijing Summer Olympics. And we spoke in late 2021 before the Beijing Winter Olympics, which happened in 2022. So the Beijing 2008 Olympics were a symbol of China trying to tell the world that it was opening up, whereas the Beijing 2022 Olympics, you know, here we are looking back at it, were really a symbol of China saying we're closed to the world. It really didn't welcome the world. Do you think that Xi Jinping's endgame might be that he's hoping that Russia eventually falls, Putin falls, and that China can gain a dominant position over Russia, and also that China can gain multi-billion dollar contracts in the rebuilding of Ukraine? Is this really Xi Jinping looking at another long game to increase China's steps toward world domination?
Yes, absolutely. I think we shouldn't be in any doubt that Xi Jinping's goal, whatever form it takes, is always world domination. And we also shouldn't be in any doubt that this is a regime that can never be trusted to keep its word. It's broken an international treaty over Hong Kong, and it doesn't believe in the international rules-based order except when it suits it. So I think its role in the question of Ukraine is always and only in terms of what its own interests and long-term goals are, and therefore China positioning itself as a peacemaker should be viewed with a high degree of skepticism. Of course, you know, if they can play some kind of constructive role, that should be considered. But I think we should view it with a lot of skepticism and concern. Because Xi Jinping is only interested in one thing, and that's his interests and goals.
Benedict Rogers, co-founder of Hong Kong Watch and journalist from the UK. He's author of The China Nexus, 30 Years in and Around the Chinese Communist Party's Tyranny. Benedict, before we leave you, where can people get more information about Hong Kong Watch Canada?
Well, thank you. The easiest place is to go to our website, which is www.hongkongwatch.org. ORG.
Thanks again, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you.
What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, China's defense minister worried over international support for Taiwan. Meeting with Singapore's defense minister, Chinese military officials mentioned DPP's efforts to secure allies. The spokesperson for the ministry, after a closed-door meeting between Chinese defense minister Li Shang and the Singaporean defense minister Ng Eng Hen, emphasized that China will, quote, absolutely not renounce the use of force in its approach to cross-strait affairs. But, significantly, he mentioned Taiwan's ruling party, the Democratic Progressive Party, by name, rather than the typically used phrase of separatist forces. In the Kyoto News, CIA chief visited China in May as U.S. seeks to thaw tensions. The secret mission by William Burns, one of President Joe Biden's closest confidants, marked the highest level known trip by a U.S. official to China in many months, as bilateral ties further deteriorated earlier this year when the United States shot down what it described as a Chinese spy balloon traveling over its territory. On Friday, Biden's security advisor Jake Sullivan said the United States wants to engage with China and is available for military-to-military dialogue, just after the defense chiefs of the two countries exchanged greetings at a security forum in Singapore. In the Hong Kong Free Press, Police and three other Hong Kong government departments probe store days after it began Tiananmen crackdown candle giveaway. The police, buildings, labor, and environmental hygiene department paid visits to Debbie Chan's Sai Kung store within 9 days of her candle giveaway. Hong Kong Free Press noticed a police car parked outside for over 5 hours on Friday as she vowed to continue until Sunday's anniversary. Police are expected to deploy en masse to prevent gatherings in Causeway Bay, where a traditional candlelit vigil was held for decades before the security law was imposed by Beijing in 2020. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, open-air drug use is at an all-time high in downtown Portland. Police turn to citations as fentanyl crisis explodes. In Multnomah County, fatal opioid-related overdoses saw a five-fold increase between 2018 and 2022, according to public health data. A record-high 209 people in the county died from fentanyl overdoses last year. Statewide, 567 people died after taking multiple drugs in 2021, and fentanyl was detected in more than half of those cases, according to the latest data available from the Oregon Medical Examiner's Office. In the Seattle Times, Inslee rebuffs tribes seeking relief after Washington climate laws boost gas prices. Governor Jay Inslee doesn't think Washington should exempt tribal gas stations from climate laws that have driven up fuel prices across the state since taking effect at the start of this year, he told tribal leaders last week. Though Washington's average price at the pump is lower than a year ago, the difference between Washington's average price and the national average has grown by about 50 cents a gallon, according to AAA data. Suppliers are citing the climate laws with surcharges on fuel invoices. In Czech news, impressive 62-meter superyacht with helipad docks in Victoria. With a top speed of 16 knots, the yacht called Sea Explorer 62 Anwa was built in 2020 and is worth $100 million, according to the website superyachtland.com. It says it can fit 12 guests and 20 crew members. The vessel is owned by Jorge Palo Leman, an 83-year-old billionaire investment banker and businessman who co-founded the private equity firm 3G Capital, that's behind brands like Burger King and Heinz. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to doctors in BC who treat brain injury survivors and the scientists researching the brain. It is Brain Injury Awareness Month in BC. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 4th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 4th of June in 1919, the U.S. Congress voted to guarantee women the right to vote by approving the 19th Amendment to the Constitution? A year after, the Canadian Parliament passed the Women's Franchise Act. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.